I love daytime recording. First off, I get the best light. I look about 5 years younger during the daytime. At night, I look weathered. I look as though life has beaten me in a TKO. But right now, I just feel great, and I always just feel like, oh man, like it feels like it's your job when you do it on the weekend. You know what I mean? It's like it feels like you just like Joe Rogan. I think we all have it harder than Joe Rogan.
Yeah. Damn it.
Yeah. And there might be people that like want to like gut him like a fish for saying something or having the wrong guy on, but like he doesn't have to work all day and then come in and do a podcast.
It's true.
Dude. I don't know. Just won't somebody think of us, Capital P podcasters.
We'll tell them that when we go on.
When we get invited, I'll be like,
easy in here,
Joe, you don't know shit, dude. You don't walk a mile in my shoes, Mr. Fear Factor.
Yeah, from the 5 to the 6, we be in the mix with that rare candy paint job on a whip. I need food for the kids, money for the rent. Fuck a lockdown, baby, I can't do that shit. And I don't never vote, cause I'm fucking broke. And either way, I know the police ain't gon' leave me alone. On a plane by the visit, Glenn Rockney. Crypto told me I should bring the Glock with me. So I packed up my piece and I'm sliding. Cause we might get caught up in a riot. Middle finger Trump, middle finger Biden. Fuck a left, fuck a right, is you riding? Know you love to see it, dudes rocking. Ain't no politics, baby, we just talking. From the birds to the bricks, we be in the mix. With that rare candy paint job on the whip, who you with?
But anyways, I am really happy to welcome a true podcast crossover, one of my favorite shows that I listen to, even when the subject matter is something I've never even heard of, which is always the best, which means you know you are connected to a show when you don't care what the subject source material is and you just know you're in for a good time. It's the Art of Darkness podcast. And you guys remember from a previous episode called Ego Death, Brad Kelly, but we actually brought his co-host on, Kevin Kautzman, and they run an awesome show. Now, everybody hit pause, go check them out, and then make sure you go to patreon.com/artofdarkpod. Yeah. And look, dude, first off, if I had one criticism of Art of Darkness, it's you guys give away a lot of stuff for free that I would get so scheming patty hands and be like, oh, you want to know how this guy died? Yeah. All right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or like, you want to know the last 10 years of his life? Hop over. But you guys really give away like a huge thing. Have you guys ever thought about just swiping it away from people every once in a while? Like,
yeah, well, you know, we like giving away things for free. We're generous, you know, generous in spirit. But you know, I can definitely see a version in the future where it looks a little different in terms of what's behind the paywall and what's not, but we'll figure that out.
Brad,
as we go.
You did the one episode where you released a core episode just for Patreon, and that saw a boost, you know, Dennis Johnson. So yeah, we talk about it. We want to create like a thing that stands on its own, that's outside of the paywall. I think that was always our kind of goal. Right. Mm-hmm. But we're scheming, because in the long run, Brad and I we're both family men. We're both busy guys. We got a lot going on. In the long run, we'd love to see it become a sustainable thing that we could do for another 10, 20 years until one of us falls off the face of the earth or what have you. Yeah. But thank you. And I'm glad to be on Rare Candy. I am a fan, especially since we had you on, Glenn. I have really begun to listen to Rare Candy in a pretty devoted way. So this is cool.
Yeah. That was a lot of fun. I did actually. Yeah, I did make my AOD debut about a month or two ago. It feels, I don't know. Podcast time is like a completely
months
different,
yeah,
completely
like
different thing. I have no idea when anything ever happens, but yep. I went on to talk about Edgar Allan Poe and some really cool stuff on there. So if you guys want an entry point, I guess, from this show, go ahead and check that one out. Yeah, and
a lot of fun. It was cool to have you, man. We'll get you back in there someday.
I will do anything. You know. And by the way, you will be sued if you do the Michael Crichton episode without me. I'm just it's not, I don't mean to say that like in a mean way. I'm just saying.
Yeah. No. There was some chatter about that in our Telegram or somewhere. And I immediately was like, well, Glenn's got to be involved with that. There's no way
I know your lawyer is Dan Baltic, but I'm willing to put my guy who's not, I haven't hired yet. I guess it can't be him, but you know, that'd be funny if it was. If I just was like, actually, he's my lawyer
under another screen name.
If my retainer was $5 more, yeah,
right. It's in court. It's the Nut Man versus Dan Baltic.
Exactly. Yeah. So I had a question for both of you guys. Now we talked about this with Brad a little bit last time, but I want to hear from both of you guys. All right. So somebody gives you a proposition or a threat, right? You have to switch lives with one of your subjects. Lives, complete lives, one for one. Who do you pick? Whoa. You guys have covered a lot of people, and some people I know who I wouldn't pick from you guys. Like, I wouldn't pick like David Foster Wallace, because I wouldn't pick that. I wouldn't pick Lovecraft.
No.
But there's a few. Well, who would you got? Who do you guys think? I mean,
that's a pretty good question. I don't know, Kevin, did any leap to mind?
The first thing that pops to my mind is Stanley Kubrick, because he lived a good long life. He was obviously a genius and no greater filmmaker. There are different degrees of greatness, but in terms of the medium, what he accomplished, the span of his interests, right? You've got Barry Lyndon over here. You've got Eyes Wide Shut over here. He kind of did it all. And was also somehow self-made and stood aside from the industry. He didn't need Hollywood. I mean, yeah, in any case. And his life seems to have been, I mean, he was, cruel to his actors and had problems like anybody else. But he seemed to really, of the subjects we covered, I wouldn't say he was a monster the way that like Brando was.
You got to be a little cruel to your guys. You can't be.
Making a movie. It's a dictatorship. Yeah. Right? I mean,
He was a regular prick. He was just like a regular prick. Like, but with like the juice to know how good he was, with some self-awareness and not really even trying to mend relationships. He was kind of like, look, man, this is a movie. Like, we don't ever have to speak to each other ever again. Like, it's totally fine. Or I'll call you 50 times a day, maybe,
Well, and that's it. And I used to hang out with an old timer in Manhattan at this bar that they used to call me the mayor of this bar, which is maybe some insight into my personal darkness. But and it was in an Indian restaurant, and this old timer there worked on practical effects for movies, including Rosemary's Baby. He loved to tell the story about the pig's blood for Rosemary's Baby.
Wow.
But he also worked on 2001. And so all you had to do to get him going after he had a few glasses of white wine was to mention Stanley Kubrick, and he'd go, that fuck, I hate that guy was so, because apparently Stanley, 8 a.m. phone would ring in Manhattan and in New York, and he would be on the line and he would just give them an ear beating for an hour. And it was over the models in 2001, the little, anyway, so fun little anecdote.
No, 2001, I mean, you figure out how many times he's had like some of the greatest achievements of film. Like, I mean, just it, I probably wouldn't be that nice of a guy if I did that. Like, it's like, dude, I just made a space movie that is 4,000 times sicker than the people who think I made the moon landing footage. Like, I actually made it's insulting that you think I made the moon landing footage, because it looks like shit compared to what I did in the 60s. That looks better than Star Wars. That was 10 years later, almost. Like, it's just, it looks, I mean, I know it's not a hot take or anything, but that is still, to me, probably the greatest, when you take everything into account, the greatest achievement in film, like, ever. I mean, it's
one of the for sure.
We're gonna get you right back to the episode, but I just wanted to let you guys know of a few other things we offer at Rare Candy Industries. We have a Substack with free and paid subscription options. Free subscribers get access to all written content. That includes Bob's Red Pill. That's the best thing going on the internet right now, trust me. Paid subscribers get full access to our premium episode feed, and that's just every episode we don't necessarily want to share with the general public, if you know what I'm saying. Again, that's rarecandy.substack.com. We also have merch. That link's a little long for me to say right now, but go to the description, go to our merch store, and find a shirt that's right for you. We have Rare Candy shirts, Dr. Bronner soap label shirts, Rishi mushroom shirts, all types of stuff there. Check it out. There's got to be something for you. And lastly, check us out on social media. On Instagram, we're Rare Candy Pod, but on Twitter, we're at Rare Candy Pod 1. All right, enough of that. Let's get you back into the episode.
You know, I have another little 2001 factoid while Brad gets his brain wrapped.
I'm literally looking, because I'm like, man, everyone I think of, I'm like, I don't want that.
Pick Joseph Conrad, dude. Pick Joseph Conrad. No, I'm kidding.
So I saw a screening of 2001 at the United Palace in Washington Heights, which is this big renovated old movie houses, like one screen. It's a whole long story, but the last film that they screened, I think in the 60s before it shut down and then turned into like some like evangelical church bought it and took care of it. But then now they screen movies there. It was 2001. So they screened it again a few years ago, and they had one of the actors who played one of the astronauts. I can't remember if it was Poole or Bowman, but the actor came on, you know, on stage and kind of gave an introduction. He gave an entire speech that he remembered, which had been cut from the film. So he was getting to live a fantasy, but he pointed out there's a continuity error in 2001 that everybody can enjoy. You know, when he gets to the space station on his way, I think, to the moon, you know, you have all those incredible moments where he's in the space station and he goes and he meets, I think, the international scientists who don't have the clearance and don't quite know what's going on. Do you know the scene I'm talking about?
Uh-huh, of course. Yeah.
There is I can't remember the color exactly, but it might be blue or red, but there's a shawl or some sort of a coat that's hanging over one of the chairs in that scene. And between cuts, you can see it goes missing. And so it's a very clear, very glaring continuity error in 2001. If you pay attention closely, there was no way for him to cut around it. So he added in a voiceover saying, there's a lost jacket or something, you know, a few moments later, just so it's covered because it's Kubrick. We're not nothing is going to be out of place. In any case, look for that in 2001. It was such a cool story. And the actor said, you know, he and his wife had seen the movie so many times. His wife finally caught it and said, oh my God, look at this. So there you go. Yeah. Kubrick's famous attention. Yeah.
And not only is that right, Stanley Kubrick was a guy that was doing exactly what he should be doing in life. I think that's fair to say. But also the fact is that we as a society benefited from him not doing anything else, because he would have been a serial killer, I think, if he you think about that stuff, like all these guys that have these weird things where you're like, well, that guy was a weirdo. It's like, yeah, but what if he like didn't have this all encompassing psychotic obsession with making film, which consumes your whole life, basically? Like, if that dude just had like idle time in a hotel, dude, are you kidding me?
Yeah, he'd be a serial killer, or like the government would have to recruit him into like counterintelligence or something.
Right.
Like,
I think we're living through some of this. I think a lot of these guys are building apps. You know, it's not good. We need to get people back into the theater and back into the arts. I'm quite serious. I mean,
I agree.
It's an element. It's like we're putting way too much value on the big spreadsheet in the sky. We need to be getting back into the arts for sure. It's one of the theses of our pod. Brad, you had to have made a choice by now.
Yeah,
right?
No, yep. I'm kind of thinking through it. I mean, for me, so many of the people we cover sort of intentionally have like stuff that happened to them, or stuff that they did, or stuff that they had to like live through the remorse of. And so I don't really want any of those stories, right? Like, I think somebody who didn't, this is actually the that one behind the paywall core episode we mentioned, Dennis Johnson. You know, came out of the Washington DC area, had traveled as a kid because his dad was, his speaking of intelligence, his dad was in somehow it was a CIA liaison, and then kind of super talented right out of the gate, has some dissolute years where he's drinking and doing drugs and he's kind of lost, and then kind of throws himself back in the scene a little bit later than, you know, maybe a lot of writers kind of get their big break, and then just writes some of the greatest works of American fiction of the last 20, I guess 30 years now, and lives kind of a cool life at the back end of it, right? Sort of went through his bumps and bruises, but definitely figured it out. And at the end, you're like, yeah, I would live on my ranch in Idaho and just crank out a novel every few years. That sounds pretty good.
I think eventually, I know you guys will be covering Cormac McCarthy.
This year.
He'd be a candidate for me. Like, if I had to just pick one, I mean, he definitely had some, like, I don't want to live in the shack, the like no running water shack for that long personally. Yeah. But I mean, okay, is it that or Mishima? Do I want to be Mishima?
Right,
no, probably
right,
not. No. I love that he existed, but yeah. No. Yeah. And you know, I will say one of the best recent episodes that you guys have is, you know, we're a little biased on this program, but I would say John Lennon. I mean, he that just There were things I thought I knew everything about him, but there were just certain things. A lot of the stuff with his mom, you know, and all that stuff is really interesting. And that's another guy. Thank God he could make music, because I don't think it would have gone well if he didn't. Think we might have. I think he actually prolonged his life, is actually my hot take, by making music. Truly. I think he was a goner early in some weird bar fight or something. Somebody just ices him out, because he was kind of a ruffian, you know, like kind of a one of those kids that punches somebody just to like stand out, you know, like
it would have gotten weirder and boozier as it went on if he hadn't had
that episode as an example. Like, how much research are you doing? How long I read like a novel every couple weeks, and I feel like I'm like maxed to the gills. You know what I mean? And how long, both of you, I want to hear for both of these. I'm just using Lennon as an example, but like for any of these episodes, dude, how does it, books, movies? I mean, how do you do it?
Well, I can speak to the Lennon episode, and then maybe I'll segue into some. We can talk about one that Brad's done, because that's the shtick of the show, of course, is that I prepare an episode, do the biographical profile of a dead artist, then Brad does the same, and we go back and forth. Yeah. So obviously with John Lennon, we're talking about, this is somebody we'd call Big Air, right? You already kind of in your head know John. He's a poster. John Lennon's a poster. And obviously I have a very long personal relationship with the Beatles. My mother was a huge Beatles fan. I took her to see Paul here in St. Paul. One of my favorite memories. But in the case of, John, I knew we were dealing with somebody that is like, there's so much ink has been spilled about John Lennon. I got two of the biographies. I got the one great biography. I can't remember the name of it off the cuff, but if you go listen to the episode, I'm very clear about it. And when the biography that I got for John Lennon, and in the background, I can see if I can find it, you know, as this episode goes on, but it was so well written. And that's one thing about this show, is if you get a book that reads like a novel, and this biography of John Lennon was written by a novelist and had that quality, the rest of the job becomes easy. Because then I can go and kind of, you know, I can go to Wikipedia and some other sources and just get the spine of his life and then dip in and out of this book. I don't have to read this 1,200 page book cover to cover. I feel like I have enough of a storytelling ability and enough of a sense of history and my own, I guess, voice, where it's like, then it's a little bit paint by numbers by now. Like, I know how to do an Art of Darkness episode. I kind of know what I feel like we have to cover. And then the rest kind of does itself. So, I mean, in terms of hours and everything, I mean, I think a good core episode probably takes 20 hours to prepare, would just be a guess. I mean, and what I'll do is I'll throw on like media in the background. Now, in the case of John and the Beatles, I didn't need to go back into the catalog so much. Like, been a part of my life for 20 years, forever. In fact, from the time I was born. But I'll throw on biographies and documentaries, and I watched A Hard Day's Night. You try to like saturate yourself with the personality of the character, so it doesn't just end up being kind of a dry reading of text. You know, you want to be able to be a little extemporaneous. I mean, I call the episodes seances, which is maybe a little high flown, but I mean, I sometimes feel the presence of the person. Sure. You know, that's like a summoning thing. Yeah. Anyway, Brad, how did you, so let's take the Conrad episode.
Conrad, for sure. That was what I was going to say too.
Sure. Yeah. Well, in Conrad, it's tricky because it differs somewhat depending on what medium the person works in. So, you know, you do a writer and their work is the written word, so you got to read. But you know, if you do an episode on Andrei, you know, did an episode on the Russian director Andrei Tarkovsky,
phenomenal.
Phenomenal. I didn't read quite as much for that. I made sure to watch all of his films, because there was two or three that I hadn't seen before, so I made sure to watch those. And then I did read some biographical material, but like in the Conrad episode, I had read I don't know, three or four of his books, I guess, before doing that. So I ended up reading Heart of Darkness again, and the one about the terrorist.
Secret agent.
Yeah. I keep thinking The Last Tyrant. And then a bunch of short stories. But in determining what to read from their work, I usually start with the biography, depending on how familiar I am with them. And that will help me understand what of their work is like most relevant to them biographically, because what's most relevant to them biographically is not necessarily the same as what is their big book, like that everybody knows about. Right. Mm-hmm. So as you kind of go through that, you kind of realize like, oh, you know, Joseph Conrad had different books and stories based on different aspects of his life, different parts of his career as a seaman. And then you kind of pick and choose in there what you're going to end up reading. But I mean, I usually read the biographies pretty extensively. Yeah. There's sometimes they get quite long though. I mean,
oh yeah.
Like Kevin's talking, you know, it's not uncommon for a well-known public figure for their biography to be 800 pages, 900 pages. And, you know, you're going to try and cram that into a 4-hour show. You know, you're not putting everything in there. There's just no way to do that, right? But like, I'm working on an episode for the Marquis de Sade, though. Oh. Professor Hext tell us yesterday it's supposed to be Marquis.
No, it's Marquis in the French, but apparently the English would say Marquis.
Okay. Yeah, so yeah, he yeah. is the Marquis de Sade. So I, you know,
Scantling. Yeah.
So I got this, you know, I got this biography. I'll read almost all of it. And then, then kind of pick up whatever material.
Well, you know, and for the Marquis de Sade, there's going to be some field research too, isn't there?
Yeah.
We don't talk. We don't.
Aren't you dedicated, Brad? Come on, dude. Like, I mean, 20 hours.
I will tell you, I didn't realize this dude was like making up moves in the 1700s. Like, he did stuff. I was like, I didn't know anybody ever did that. That doesn't even make. And it actually, it's the craziest. I can't even recommend it, but 120 Days of Sodom is one of the most unsettling reads of my life.
I bet. I mean, no, there's that time was weird. Like when you have like the Milton, I mean, not time, I'm talking about a span of, you know, 100 or so years, but like Milton and all that stuff, like those people were really tapped into something like that. I'm not sure we still need to be even tapped into, to be honest, but like, I just, the fact that we don't anymore, like we're kind of like post that, and it's like, but those guys with the books and the way they were living and stuff, you know, I guess, you know, do you guys think you have to be dark to be successful?
I think you have to be human. And I think that a fully realized human life is going to have to wrestle with all of that. And I'm a huge David Lynch fan. And if you haven't read his Catching the Big Fish, I would encourage that if you're an artist or interested in creativity. And he very famously in that book says, listen, you don't, a lot of young artists feel like they need to cultivate their suffering, cultivate their, I don't know the exact words, but you know, you have that sort of like suffering artist vibe. And he's like, that's ridiculous. Life is going to throw enough of it at you. Don't cultivate it. You're not going to be your most creative if you're in pain all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy who made Eraserhead. So what does that tell you? So I'm sort of that school. I don't know. Do you have to? I mean, we haven't covered a subject yet who's unblemished, shall I say. And often the greatness does correspond to crimes and sins, but not always. No. So it's not a case where you don't have to be a Marlon Brando to achieve Brando-like results. So I think the short answer is, like, no, you don't have to lean into it. But yes, you're human, so you have it. And the stuff that people want, the stuff that people resonate with, has that shade of darkness. The most comic stuff is kind of laced with a sadness and a tragedy and even like a mean-spiritedness. And the most tragic stuff is then sort of laced with levity and comedy. And I've said for a long time, and Brad has known me for a long time, there are really only two interesting things, sex and death. And there you go. Brad, what do you think?
Good. I tend to agree. I think it's really easy to, well, one thing, it's sort of like, even if some darkness, sins committed against you or by you, is a crucial ingredient for, say, some kind of artistic greatness, it also, like, 999 out of 1,000 times crushes people, right? Like, some of the stuff that we might think of as like, oh, you know, like Anna Kavan wrote these great novels because she went insane. Well, yeah, a bunch of other insane people went insane in that same asylum as her, and nobody knows anything about those people. So that's on the one hand, it's like it can kind of stick out. It's sort of survivor bias or whatever. I do think there has to be, it's sort of a corollary of like, the most interesting things happen to people who know how to tell the story about them. Mm. And so I don't know that you have to, cultivate darkness, or you even have to have anything particularly dark about you. Everybody's got something, some weird secret, some fear, some kind of pain. And if you can get in touch with that, then I think to some degree, right. Then I think there's more than enough. I guess almost like the answer is yes, but
yeah,
the amount is there's plenty for everybody to go around.
And it's not an excuse for bad behavior, and it doesn't mean that you have to turn into a total bastard. It's not a get out of jail free card for bad behavior for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I always tell this story, like, my aunt and uncle lived by San Jose State University in the 60s when this happened. And they lived next door to this weird band that was doing seances and stuff, but they were like tweakers and stuff. Like, they didn't look like they had their shit together. Right. And we're like, oh man, who was like, and they're telling me it's Fleetwood Mac. The American part of Fleetwood Mac is there. Lindsey Buckingham, he's a Bay Area guy. Stevie Nicks spent time in the South Bay as a child, who she was kind of all over California. But that they were there, and they were like, all of a sudden, and my aunt and uncle are not like party people or anything like that. So they're kind of like almost like the neighbors in Beavis and Butthead, kind of like just kind of what the hell's going on over there.
Right,
but
right.
They were all of a sudden, like, you know, a couple years. This is when they were like a struggling blues band and stuff. But then, like, mm-hmm. a couple of years later, it's just like, wait, really? Like, these people are like ran the music industry essentially for like when they were, I mean, they still have maybe the most popular huge. Album ever. Like, yeah, it's crazy.
One of the best shows I ever saw, Fleetwood Mac in New Jersey, I think in 2018. Somebody took me to see it. And I never would have gone to this. And I'm way, way in the back. It was like boomer paradise. It was just staggering.
Yeah,
what a moment. I was watching the boomers watch the show. It was incredible. I felt so happy.
I love that feeling. I love that
feeling. I really was. I'm going to go see Bob Dylan, the great Minnesotan Bob Dylan, and Willie together. I mean you'd be there for the thing as much as the experience.
Yeah, for sure. It'll be interesting to watch.
So that'll be fun.
Yeah, it's in a way, it's sort of sometimes surprising that guys from that era are still alive and doing things, just because it feels like we live on a different planet. In some ways, it feels like we live on a different planet than the one that they got started on.
And the ones that get taken early, it's like, there doesn't seem to be a science to it either. It's like Keith Richards is around. He's alive. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and that dude was communicating with Satan and doing all these crazy things, putting all sorts of toxic waste into his body.
He's good. Yep.
Yeah, no big deal. Yeah, he's just alright. Kenneth Anger lived forever, you know, like all these guys, like they live for so long. There doesn't seem to be any science of it. But Kevin, you brought up Minnesota, and I'm glad. I've been, for some reason, I mean, probably because we just did a Prince episode.
I listened. Mm-hmm. Very, very good. Yeah, that gets the
Some of the Prince fans on YouTube are like, you actually got his age wrong when he looked at the Yellow Pages when he was 16 years old. I'm like, I don't care. I will never edit that.
I am renting a room right now. My studio right now is from a friend. It's in a friend's house. And he, I'm not going to say hung out with Prince, but he was like, he was with people who knew Prince. So it's like, here, it's a thing, like a real thing. Like my soon to be mother-in-law, she always tells a story about how when they were younger, she and a friend were out on like a Thursday or Friday night. And a couple of people came over and said, hey, you want to come over, come out to Prince's house. And like the pancake story is true. And they would send a limo or a car, and he would just bring cool looking, hip, young scene people out to his place and try new music on them and play music and throw a party. And then she does say Prince didn't serve the pancakes.
Ah, yeah.
Prince's feet. But anyway, yeah. So yeah, huge, obviously, here.
So, he's kind of like Willy Wonka, where it was like, you just like, hey, you purple down to the purple, essentially, like a little guy that's like very dry and stoic, out of nowhere could start singing from his the pit of his stomach and talk about some stuff that nobody would ever talk about in a pop song. But like again, Minnesota, I mean, you have like Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, you have all these band, Bob Dylan, you have all these Husker Du, right? Are they Minnesota? Yeah, I think there's all right. These bands that are from there. What is it about that place? Because I just think of Fargo.
You think of the show Fargo. Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing about the show. See, now the show Fargo, people have a tendency to think that it's like ironic and interesting because this isn't a violent place. I think we all know that this place can be as violent as anywhere in the world. It gets very real out here. Mm-hmm. I've always resented because I'm not from Minnesota, but I think I'm honorary by now. I have children by two different women from Minnesota. Nice. So hopefully, you know, and I'm not setting up franchises, you know, this should be it, but you get the idea. It's like, I've been here a long time. I went to the U. I consider myself an adopted Minnesotan, but it's very different from where I grew up, North Dakota. Like there's a lot of little nuances and things. What were we talking? Oh, Fargo. Yeah, no, it's that Prairie Home Companion vision of Minnesota. I'm so glad, good riddance, that that's sort of been wiped off the face of the earth, both by recent events and also sort of the healer kind of going
that's
away.
True. 2020, yeah, I mean, get rid of it. Yeah,
listen, it was always bullshit. It's always been bullshit. It's always a lie. Like, I come from the place where people die from overdoses and fucking
right.
It's poverty and trailers and all that shit. And then you have this weird kind of nice, whatever, like this idea that it's not a city, it's just one big suburb. Not true. You've got, there's a real city here. It's called Minneapolis and St. Paul. What is it? I mean, there's long ass winters, a very reasonable cost of living even now. I mean, hey, you know, go pop on Trulia and see what it takes to get into a starter home in St. Paul. You might be surprised. One of the most educated populations in the country in terms of bachelor's degrees. I know that doesn't necessarily count for that much, but it's a fairly educated population. And there's been a vibrant art scene. There's a living theater scene here. There's a great music scene here. There's tons of venues. It's the kind of place where people will leave, go to New York, and then come back and then just start doing stuff here because they realize, like, you can't quite unless you have a bunch of money, you know? So it's got a real DIY vibe. I mean, one of my favorite, we got Harmar Superstar. I know he kind of had issues or whatever, but, you know, one of my favorite Minnesota cultural products is Mystery Science Theater 3000. I think MST3K is just this iconic, and excellent. There's something about that DIY style that kind of defines Minnesota. And I mean, yeah, so it's often slept on. It's also like kind of the edge of the world. Like if you look at a map of like the light in North America, like at night, we're kind of it until like Denver, or, you know, this is it. This is the last big city before the light falls off and you get into the big empty Great Plains. And I know there are different little cities. There's Omaha, and yeah, you got Fargo and bit, but this is it. So it creates a kind of weird, we kind of quietly come with a chip on our shoulder too. Like, hey, we're out here too. So
I like it. I like when people talk about, you know, whether it's their hometown or a place that they've, you know, called their home for a long time. I love hearing about it. Like, I have friends out here that claim the weirdest cities in the Bay Area that nobody cares about, like, whatsoever. Like, we have a town called Milpitas out here, and it's built on a landfill, just pure landfill, and it smells like it too. No joke. Like, you'll be on the freeway, the neighboring freeway, and it smells terrible. Oh. And but there was one guy who was like, we brought up that it smelled bad, and he's like, don't ever say that around me. And I was like, well, I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, come on, dude. Like, you know it smells.
You know it smells.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know, man. He's like, I just wouldn't show up on, like, you know, Calaveras Street saying that, dude. I'm like, I've seen Calaveras Street. There's like Toyota Sienna minivans just driving around everywhere. But I love, now that in retrospect, 15 years later, I love going like, yeah, you know what, dude? Like, you should be excited about your hometown like that. Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so, enjoy it, or, you know, get some out of it, or go somewhere else. I mean,
right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I want to know about how this podcast, Art of Darkness, formed, because you guys are similar. Like, Cy and I have known each other since eighth grade. I think you guys, if I have this correct, met in grad school.
Yeah.
Or something like that. But that's, you know, that's still a reasonable amount of time to be knowing somebody in a sphere of Twitter where most people are like, I haven't seen my co-host's face before.
Right.
You know, like, right, like, cause, right, right. And he won't share any information with me because he thinks I'm a Fed, you know, like that. That's, it's a very strange world to
it's not
be
even
in.
A joke. It's not even a joke.
It's not a joke. Like, it's funny to talk about, but yeah, I'm like, dude, they'll be like, yeah, we did our first face docs 2 years in. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
These are the same people who will warn you about MK Ultra and you go, you guys realize you're living it, right?
Yeah. You're doing it.
You're in it. Yeah.
My Lady Avi is not. It's not.
This is a safe space for the M'ladies. I love the M'ladies. I'm a huge M'ladies respecter. One of my major group chats with some of the key women in my life. It's called M'ladies Fan Club. So this is a shout out to the M'ladies. Yeah, I've been in crypto for a long time.
Have you?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So oh, yeah. We're kind of back, aren't we?
Oh, we're back.
Okay. This started out as, I mean, the guy's name is Crypto Psy, and that's not like a philosophical, like, crypto transgressor. He was a trader. Our first five episodes, he's like working the charts. Nice. He's like on there. So,
are we going to make it funny? And I got to say, because I've been like on and off back on Twitter, like three accounts now, four accounts deep or so. And the crypto Twitter is way more fun than whatever we got going on. I don't hate us, like our little think circle we got going on, but the crypto Twitter people have way more fun than we do, and they're not less like, that thing's bad, and you know, and it's just like I love that. It's I gotta get back on that. I don't know
if you wanna, dude. It's now fun. I follow crypto Twitter. I mean, I'm professionally in crypto. I'll just say that. We'll leave it at that. We don't have to turn this into a crypto podcast.
Cryptozoologist.
Listen, if you want good alpha for the next cycle, follow the M'ladies. Because the M'ladies are responsible for a lot of the meme pumps, and they're quietly running the crypto market for people who are on the inside. So you can do a hell of a lot.
They're funny and they're accurate and they're smart. Yeah, you could say that.
Sure. Yeah, and I think the floor for a M'lady right now is about $15,000 in ETH, which is just incredible to think about. I was like, I should buy one of these. Never mind. They have the Schizo Bros. Like, it's a M'lady derivative. Those are incredible. They're creating this incredible art scene all online. And it's real anarchistic and it's real punk and it's real dangerous and weird. And it's, I love it. And in any case, what was the question again, Glenn? Sorry.
Well, I mean, I will ask it again, but we've talked about this since the beginning. I owned some, I was never savvy enough to trade it and do stuff like that. But I owned some. I'm like, dude, we're all on this like weird dissident thing. But there was always this like hatred towards crypto where I was like, dude, like, are you just that big of like the US dollar?
Yeah, you love the dollar.
So like, you're just like that. You just like, I love it so much and it's doing so well. You know, like I just it's so cool and I just am so pro you. I get it. That's fine. But like, I always thought that was an interesting thing. People kind of just kind of in the same way that people cast off John Lennon, right? On Twitter. They're just like, oh, loser, libtard. You're like, well, okay. But we're talking about something great here. But I actually asked how you guys met. Like, I like to talk about or not. Yeah. Well, you guys
in the show.
You guys met in school, but like, what is it be like, hey man, there's a lot of weird people that made art. Should we talk about them? Like, what is it? You know, how did that happen?
Well, this would be, I guess, our third actual podcast. Is that at least second, maybe second and a half podcast. Wow. And we'd started one, when we were in graduate school. And I think, from my end of them, they generally deteriorated into just like, being way too inebriated to actually have a show, and they weren't really aimed in any direction. They were just sort of whatever. And
sounds like us.
Yeah.
you guys are way more put together than you guys. There was just a vibe cast. We had no idea what we were doing. However, it was like
2010 or 2011.
Right. We should have been buying Bitcoin and dicking around, but
we all do that envelope math. Like, damn, if only I had that in 2009, it'd be over right now.
Yeah, sure.
I wouldn't care about anything in the world. Yeah, I would just like, exactly. So, who, like, when you guys meet, what's the first day like in the movie, like the biopic? Does Kevin go up to Brad and be like, "What's up, dude? Like, how does it work? What happened?"
I feel like,
and how are the other grad students? I need to hear some, like, it wasn't all cool like you guys, I bet.
I flunked out of college. I love cringe.
Yeah, come on, let's hear.
Well, we probably met in there's a class that all of the first years took together. We probably met at in that class, I would assume, I think it's probably the first time. I mean, they did try to like organize events where you would like meet each other, but I don't think I met you. Maybe there's an orientation or something. I don't know.
There might've been. But we definitely met and got to know each other through that class and everybody. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And you know, cause that's an interesting time. Just like when a person first goes away to college. I mean, I didn't go away to college. I went to college by my parents' house. So when you go away to college, but you're also, there's that same thing where like everybody here doesn't know anybody. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely like much more of it's easier to make friends when you're like 12 people who also don't have friends.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I think, you know, I'm kind of sorted into little, groups, subgroups of that larger group and, go to the bar. And there's we were fortunate enough to have a graduate school situation where, we got it. We didn't have a teaching load, which a lot of people in graduate school would have. And particularly people getting MFAs like we did would normally have. So there was kind of a lot of free time. And I mean, you could use it to write, but you could also use it to get into trouble. So I feel like I split the difference on those two pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, and then flash forward 10 years ish, and it's the pandemic time, 7 years, yep. 7, 8 years. We stayed in touch. We worked on these other kind of failed podcasts, and then pandemic time happens. And I think a lot of people did this during the pandemic. And I think there are a lot of dead podcasts now that were started then. I think we came up with an idea together. We batted it around and we just said, why don't we do, you know, biographies of dead artists and cover it. And we batted names around. What was the terrible name that I came up with?
Oh God.
Heart of Artness.
Something like that. Yeah.
Horrible. Hang on. It's a size next. That'll be size next crypto. Hashtag heart. Yeah. But anyway, And we just batted around, and then Brad jumped in and did Burroughs right away. And you know, we knew we had something in the first 3 or 4 months because people started to want to come on. Which was cool.
That was interesting. Awesome. People started asking to come on. And at first we were like, we don't have guests on. That's not what the show is.
Right.
And, you know, we eventually kind of figured out how to like make it work and learn how to do the episodes, learned how to we started doing these dark room episodes like what you came on for, Glenn, which gave us an avenue to have guests on without making them, you know, commit to some multi-hour thing. There's been evolutions along the way, but it's kind of all sort of makes sense from that first episode, I think, like the evolution of it. You can kind of see it all there. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what the, you know, I think part of the motivation for like the subject matter was the sort of theme of it is, well, you know, one thing, and I can only speak for myself here, but actually flashing back to graduate school, which was like my first exposure to what the writing world is like. I mean, I knew a couple people from college before that who wrote and had published, but nothing on that scale where it's like this little factory for producing writers is the idea.
That's crazy. I kind of forget that about you, Brad, because before I got there, I had already done this other film. I was very much in the theater world, kind of that side of things. So yeah, I forgot that about you. Yeah.
I mean, I knew a couple people in Idaho, but so anyway, in that translation, you know, like I still had a lot of fire in my belly and was a bit wilder than I am now. And there was this moment I had where it was just like, they want this shit to be so fucking boring.
Yes.
Why do they want it to be so boring? We're not supposed to be boring.
No.
Like, and I wasn't even thinking like we should be doing like Hunter S. Thompson shit. I was just like, why are you like, why is there a schedule? Like, why am I reporting to a place at a time? This is ridiculous.
Oh, man.
Like, if you want me to be able to develop as an artist, then I need to be able to do some, like, not even wild, but I need to... Give me out of structure, I think, exactly.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. And so it made me kind of thinking back, sort of like wanting to look at all the artists who not necessarily like broke down boundaries in some sort of cliched way, but like, let's look at what the life of an amazingly successful artist actually is. And you'll find out that it's not about going to conferences. It's not about getting things in on time, right? It's not about doing your taxes. There's like so many things that it's not about at all. And I thought, you know, those stories still are interesting to me.
No, you're supposed to lose sense of time when you're making it. Like, truly, like right now we're reading a book by Samuel Delaney called Dahlgren. The entire book is just a guy that has no idea what's going on because he's just writing poetry. And he's just like, they'll be like, hey man, like, where have you been the last 3 weeks? He's like, dude, I just saw you yesterday. They're like, no, yeah. Like that was 3 weeks ago. Like, and it's like this dystopian, cool. Like anarchist, yeah. Like punk thing, like where they're all living. It's like a Chaz kind of like area that they're living in. But it's just, it's relatable in that sense where I'm like, man, my work day goes by at a different rate than when I'm doing this. Right.
Yeah.
Like we recorded, I'm sure you guys know this. Like we recorded for like 3 hours yesterday. It felt like an hour. You know what I mean? Like it just was nothing. From the 5 to 6, we be in the mix with our Rick paid job on the wheel. I need food for the kids, money for the one thing I notice on Art of Darkness podcast, you guys are very diplomatic about how much you guys want to let out about certain things you might believe in.
Sure.
Something I could maybe take notes from, but
it's different. It's different shows. That's all. That's all.
Yeah.
That's
no, okay. I agree. I agree. I know what you guys, I mean, I get it. Like it's, you guys don't lose anything by doing that, which I think is good. Mm-hmm. Like, cause there's that. Now, Kevin, anytime like the pharmaceutical industry gets brought up, there's always, he doesn't like, yeah, there's no way you were going to escape this on this show. But like, yeah, we're I had to find out about this. You have a pretty hard line. I won't call you anti anything, but I'll just say you kind of are outspoken, not really like, both sides this and that. You're kind of like, no, that's an evil industry. So,
Yeah. I mean, I have a personal story about it that gets really heavy, but I mean, and I've told this online a number of times and I don't need any hemming or hawing or like,
no, sorry
or whatever. But you know, when I was 4 years old, my father overdosed from a pharmaceutical that never should have been on the market. It's called propoxyphene. You can look it up. As early as the late 70s, they were already warning saying, hey, this isn't good. This can kill people. They finally took it off the market in the UK in 2005 and then in the United States in 2010. It went under the name Darvon Darvocet. It's an opioid. This is another thing. It's not an opioid crisis in America. It's a fixture of American life, and it has been for 50 years. It's not a crisis if it's a fixture and nothing changes. It's baked in. And so in any case, this propoxyphene is not very effective at killing pain. And if you take it in slightly elevated doses and or with alcohol, it will just stop your heart if you're unlucky. And this is what killed my father. So I didn't get to have a father. Now, he had other problems. He's an addict. And, you know, we have addiction in the family. He was, you know, was not a saint. So I don't want to paint that picture either. But you grow up with that. You find that out kind of as you get into adulthood. I was actually down in grad school when I kind of got all the medical records and everything, kind of found this out. Yeah, I've got a little bitterness in my heart toward that industry. And so a little natural skepticism, which I think maybe carried me through the recent manufactured fake plague, fake.
Let's go.
PSYOP in a way where I go, you know, maybe, you know, the Christian Scientists have something going for them. Maybe there's something going on over there. And, you know, and listen, Western medicine is outstanding. If you've got a broken leg and a bone sticking out of your leg, there's no better medicine than Western medicine because Western medicine evolved during wartime and for military. Yeah. Everything in the West is about military shit. It has been forever. All right, fine. We're very good at like killing people and mending people that we've tried to kill or our own guys. Da da da. Okay. You know, but this is a cliche, right? We're not good at preventative medicine. We're not good at holistic care. We're not good at the big picture. We're terrible at mental health and psychology. Psychiatry is fugazi. Psychology is fugazi. They don't know anything. Neuroscience is a baby science. They don't know anything. And if you actually start talking to serious scientists, they go, we don't know anything.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So there you go.
Oh, yeah. Man, dude, I'll bring up my boy, Michael Crichton. There's a funny part in one of his novels called Prey, where he's been covering, you know, bioscience, all types of like crazy stuff for a long time with kind of a tongue in cheek humor towards it. But there's a part of Prey where his daughter, now it turns out to be something completely different, where his daughter, the protagonist's daughter, goes to a just wakes up with a bunch of rashes. And the day before, he had gone and got some sort of vaccination, some sort of thing for his daughter. But he didn't think much of it. He's like, well, she's with the doctors. The doctor's going to put the thing in that needs to be, you know, put in. Whatever. He's just a dad, right? He's just like a classic dad, like tech dad who wasn't thinking of. He's like, this just needs to be done. This is a part of a day that needs to be done. Well, the next day, the kid's covered in rashes, like rolling around, doesn't sleep through the night and stuff. He goes back to the hospital to talk to the doctor. And he's like, so like, is this normal? And he's like, he goes, now which shot did she come in for? He's like, you're the doctor. He's like, yeah. Like, you know, like say like, you don't know what it's like, man, that is a big red pill. I know people who actually are pharmacists, like, and they, but they talk to doctors a lot and they're like, dude, doctors are the dumbest fucking people. Like, it's not to say you shouldn't go. It's to be like, understand that you're not talking to the almighty Oz. You know what I mean? Yeah. When you go to the doctor, like just, I think we're a good, I think America's a good body shop. I don't know that we're the best mechanic.
That, I like that metaphor. You guys were really, phrase, but I guess red pill to you, like COVID was a major inflection point for you guys, from what I can hear on the pod. Is that fair to say?
More so, yeah, for me, for that, sure. More so for me than it was for him. However, I married a very holistic woman, you know, like a woman who values like naturopathic care and stuff. So I always had a positive experience with those people. Like I didn't, it wasn't like these,
you knew they weren't psychos or crazy.
I just didn't think much about it one way or another. Like I'm no joke, like a Richard Linklater character. Like I don't think about things like that. Like I for a long time, but I've always been a curious person. So we've told this a lot, but not recently. Like I remember one time, like we were starting out with COVID and it's so funny. Like you guys might relate to this too. I feel like we're way more conscious when we had no listeners of what we were saying rather than now. Like when we were young, we're like, oh, don't say that. Oh,
yeah.
Ooh, I don't want to say that. I'd be accused of this. And there's like SoundCloud porn people listening.
And
hopefully I don't piss off the pussy in bio girl that's listening to this, like or whatever. And that clicked on this and reposted it or something. Yeah. But anyways, like we were like saying this one time and I just remember like looking down one time. Our first time we ever talked about it was a couple months in, really talked about it. And like, we looked down and we're like, I saw the arrows. We had arrows in our grocery store that were kind of, and we made Pokemon jokes, like the Pokemon gym thing, like where we're like, this is so like dumb. Like there were arrows. And like everybody knew that those didn't have magical power. Like you could go against the grain, but everyone would look at the guy doing it like, dude, what, dude? Dude, don't do that. Somebody's watching. There's a camera on. Like Big Brother could just collapse this into a car compactor and take the whole Trader Joe's down because you did that. And stop the spread. And I remember like one time Cy, he's always had a bit different view on life. He's proven correct more and more every single day. But he, like, I remember one time he just texted me. He goes, you know, this is all horseshit, right?
Horseshit.
I was just like, all of it. Like, I was like, I knew all that after a while, I was like, well, I've been back to work. I've been doing something. Like, this is not nearly 28 days later. Like, this is not happening. Yeah. But I was like, all of it. And he's like, nah, let's talk.
Well, I'm still embarrassed. It didn't take us, would it take us a couple months to figure it out? I'm still embarrassed how long it took us. And actually, Serena, one of our guests, one of our friends that comes on, especially, you know, it's been a while since she's been on, but. Yeah, she was texting me like, yeah, this lockdown shit doesn't make any sense. And I was kind of defending it. I was like, well, it makes sense. You know, maybe we can, lock down a little bit. And then like the next week, I'm like, holy shit, she's 100% right. This is not. Yeah. And
I think most people had some kind of like.
There's revisionism on who likes the
situation it was. And for sure.
There's a big revisionist people where it's like, nope, I knew it from the day one. It's like, like for me, I hated my job. So when I was like, oh man, like I don't have to do this for a couple weeks. Right. Like, cool, so I was like, no, there is a patronage element to it. Some people got to work from home.
Yeah. I did. It changed my job from being mostly outdoors to being almost entirely at home. And like, I was like, this is fine for a while.
People just don't realize when like true ugly fascism happens, like the kind of treats they give you. To smooth it over. You don't really see those much in the movies, right? Like, you don't really, you're just like, wow, why is anybody falling for this? And it's like, dude, this guy's playing FIFA for six figures at home. Like, of course they're going to fall for this.
I think probably if I had a moment where I started, like, which sort of started me even thinking about it at all, was actually when they started cutting the checks to everybody. And I was like, there's no, like, this is just a cockamamie way of going, like, Why don't
this
you
can't
just
work out? Yeah.
There's clearly manipulation happening here. Nobody's thinking about the impact that this is going to have, like down the line on everything. There's sort of all these little signposts along the way. But I was like, I say this all the time, I'm just like a normal guy from like 2006.
Yeah.
You mean evil, Brad? Yeah.
Extremist.
Right. Yeah. I don't know about that. Yeah. Normal, my ass.
Yeah. So the other part was like, wait, I thought we weren't supposed to trust the big drug companies. I thought we all agreed to that like a decade ago.
We all pay lip service to that, right? Where everyone's like, oh yeah, can't trust doctors. Can't trust, right. You know, but it's 100%. When that rubber hits the road,
That went the same way as the anti-war left, Brad.
Mm-hmm. That's the same way. I was like, I thought we weren't supposed to bomb people. What the hell's going on?
Yeah, yeah. We took that earnestly back in the day. We're like, oh, we're bought into this, and then it switched, and it's like, wait, you guys changed, not yeah.
It's we have lived through one of the greatest psyops of all time. Yeah. Also, as a generation of people, the greatest bait and switch of all time, and rug pull. Yeah. I mean, we really did. We were credulous. We really kind of believed it. I think we were kind of the last chopper out of Nam in terms of actually believing it.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah.
Oh, man. It's one of those things, like, you see people that want to, like, oh, let's move on. I get it, right? Because, like, what can we do? We cannot change 2020, right? I mean, maybe I'll develop some, like, primer-like technology to do so, but I don't want to. it was a weird, like, year for everything to just change, and like, you know, personally for me, my life's been better since then. Actually, 2019 was a really bad year for me, but I wasn't alone though. Like, if I was alone during 2020, it would have been a completely different thing. If I didn't have this, it would have been a completely different thing. Like, and I know a lot of people who didn't, right? Like, I know a lot of people who didn't. Like, we had a guy on from Australia, this guy Hayden, and he was like, I used to have to FaceTime my friend once a day to make sure he didn't kill himself.
Yeah,
like it was really bad. Like, and like, if he didn't pick up, like, it was really bad, you know, because they had, in certain parts of Australia, they had like probably some of the worst violations of human rights. And, well, and we do after
they were putting people in camps. I mean, you can say, well, they weren't really camps. Yeah. They were camps. They were putting people in camps.
Oh, they were camps. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's Australia, so it was probably had like a dingo aesthetic, like, and it probably seemed kind of cool. The camp. Like,
oh, God. They're like,
no, dude, this is a camp.
Well, they had all the hot people taking selfies, like, look at me. And, you know, it's like a guy with six pack abs or like a girl in bikini, you know, like, we're at the camps. It's not a camp. Yeah. You know, right. And it was just like, this is weird, dude. Yeah.
Do you remember House Pfizer and House Moderna? Like it was
like Harry Potter. Yeah,
this really happened. This happened.
I lived in House Pfizer a couple times for a little bit. Unfortunately, I these people that were just all of a sudden. I mean, that's why. Like, and I know both of you guys can attest to this. I know you guys are both a little bit different as far as your spiritual beliefs, but I actually think you guys have more in common in the fact that, like, you guys aren't both dogmatic, I don't think, which I like.
Brad's a Catholic, even if he doesn't say it. He was baptized Catholic. He's always in. You're always in. It never leaves you.
Like, you can talk about how it's like, you know, wine that they buy it here and like bread stuff. Like, dude, all that stuff's real. Like, because that's me too, you know. Mm-hmm. And but the thing about that is, you saw people who had, you know, a complete absence of spirituality or anything beyond the material, of course they're going to fall for stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Right. Because like, of course you are. So like, it is the, you know, the quote, wherever, in the absence of this, humans will create it. Right. Mm-hmm. So in the absence it's what we did.
It 100% had the quality of a secular religious ritual.
Yes.
It was, I have to go and get my booster, and it's very invasive, and it, you know, and the doc, and everybody's in their mask. It was a massive ritual that was performed across the planet. And I guarantee they tried different strategies for different populations that were probably pre-coordinated. Not saying it was a conspiracy, but they probably already had these contingents. The Australians will put up with this much.
Yeah.
The Americans in this state will put up with this much. And also, by the way, we're going to test a lot of shit. Like, a lot of education trials were happening. It was a giant human experiment at a scale that's never before been conducted. And we're all just supposed to move on like it never happened. It's insane. It's dystopian. I will not move on, and I will not shut up about it. And I don't care if it hurts my career or anything else, because extraordinarily important. And it shows me too. I've always known this. I'm sorry to talk over you. I've always known this to be true, that we were living in this kind of reality. America does a very, very good job of kind of pasting it over. We like to think that we're not this way, but we always were. We probably always have been, as long as we've been alive. So for me, it was very validating to see it happen, because I had a lot of my suspicions verified.
I know what you mean.
Churches closed, liquor stores open. Mm-hmm. We are run by a mobocracy, and probably have been since the moment Kennedy's brains hit the back of the Lincoln car. And it's just a reality. Of course, the mob people, the godless mob people, would want the liquor stores open, the churches closed. Yeah. I don't know, you know, and we could go into more nuance, but anyway, I've had my suspicions verified, and it's kind of a relief, because now we know we're in a gloves off fight.
Yeah,
right.
It's out in the open.
So yeah, it's in the open. So thank you for making it apparent. Folks.
Agreed. Rip the Band-Aid off. Just rip the Band-Aid off.
Just let me know that I'm not free, and let the boomers know before they go to their great Fleetwood Mac concert in the sky that they were never free. Like and the cognitive dissonance and the pain that people are feeling about this right now is the most important story next to AI and tech, but it's also like the same story. And anyway, here we are.
Yeah, absolutely. That was beautiful. Yeah,
that was beautiful. And I want to know, Brad, how do you view it like spiritually right now? Because I think you guys do see the world a bit different from each other, but I think there's more common.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kevin and I are obviously we're common enough to that we can talk and not step on each other's toes, right? I think there is a. Yeah, I definitely the last since 2020, maybe even a little bit before, there is, and this is not intentional to do an Art of Darkness plug, but I think about the life of Philip K. Dick, talking about seeing the Black Iron Prison, right? This boundary, this manipulative sort of boundary layer that's sort of just under the surface of everything. And you know, he had these moments where he actually saw it, right? He actually laid eyes on the control mechanisms. And that sort of happened in these last, you know, few years. If you were paying attention to the right, to certain things, and you were looking at things a particular way, there were just obvious spectacle falsehoods taking place. And they become more transparent over time. And that's not necessarily to say that I even know what's happening or what the incentives are for people, but you just come across stuff and you're like, that's clearly not what actually happened, or that's not what that person actually said, or if that's what they said, it's not what they meant. This is all, and we're all just being sort of corralled psychologically. And so as soon as you know, and your audience is in the same boat, I'm sure. Like as soon as you start to see that, it's sort of like, hopefully it becomes harder to be manipulated.
Oh,
I'd like to think.
That's the thing. And I've always thought I hate like splitting, you know, the opposition camp into like, well, this guy is actually not really the same opposition that I am or whatever. But there were so many people that like really just spent the whole time wanting to point out like hypocrisy, like, oh, the government's being hypocrisy. Anybody who hasn't seen the Norm Macdonald bit on hypocrisy, that's how much hypocrisy means, right? Where he talks about Bill Cosby's, I'm sure everybody's heard the joke, but like the Bill Cosby, where his buddy's like, yeah, he goes, and the worst part about the whole Bill Cosby thing was was that he was a hypocrite. And the guy, and Norm goes, I'm pretty sure it was the rape, actually, that was the worst part. And because like the idea that like whoever's in power has to be coherent.
Yeah.
That's actually the reward that you get, right. Which is why I stopped trying to do that. I have conflict. I believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and that is the way to salvation. I also believe in like H.P. Lovecraft aliens underneath Antarctica. I don't have to be coherent. Nobody does. Like you just got to be ethical, man. Like there's got to be a sense of ethics behind it.
Yeah, being coherent is kind of a trap, actually, because it forces you to kind of cut off all kinds of stuff, interesting parts of your.
Agreed.
Your perspective in order to fit them into you kind of asked the sort of spiritual perspective on you know uh-huh. whatever this thing is we're talking about, right?
This it's a BCAD thing. We're in this like weird AD moment right now. Yeah. Like something happened. It's a different thing. Yeah.
I mean, the one thing, not that I was ever totally misled in this notion, but you really come around to thinking like, oh, none of those people actually give a shit about me or my family or anything that actually matters to me. So, you know, you got to play the game, you got to participate in the marketplace for a little bit, but like just none of anything they do that seems like they care about you is literally just manipulation. So just you have to understand that the truth is somewhere below or above all of that stuff.
And they think that you're a complete sucker if you believe that anything they do is for your benefit. They get off on it. Mm-hmm. They harvest your louche for the Archons by deceiving you. And they also kind of have to like show you that what they're going to do too. They're very perverse.
Oh,
That's
the worst part is when you know everything and you see it coming and people are like, they wouldn't do that. Or like the institute, and I hate the shit on the boomers too much, but the boomers' love of institutions. It's like you cannot get through to them if they are still an institution trusteur, you know, like they love the institution. The fact that like, you know, I remember like I didn't spend a long time on like the quote unquote left. I remember thinking like, well, I grew up being like a, you know, one of those decent fucking person guys. That's what in California, if you don't care about politics, like just be a decent fucking person. Yeah. And you're told that's Barack Obama, blah, blah,
which means you have to do a certain thing. Exactly. Yeah.
You have to just not care. Right. Yeah. One side has to be passionate and the other side has to not care. You're supposed to just not care. Even if you're like, well, that's kind of weird, but I don't care. That's like what every stand-up comedian does now. Like they're just like, who even cares about that? It's like, well, some people do. And but anyways, like that person. But then after a while, like I remember starting hearing certain people talking about like, oh, this leftist, this Chomsky. You hear all these names of like Chomsky. And I remember like Chomsky, like the one thing I ever liked that he like really said was like, hey, like when his form of anarchism was when I see an institution that's failing, I say, don't rescue it. Like it's done. But then this is the guy that said, let them starve to death if they don't want to take a shot. So, I mean, like to me, it's like the further away these people are from like actually applying their stuff, like,
there were so many people that had real serious, like so many public people whose opinions were on record who had, you know, real serious claims about freedom, whatever, name it.
Yeah.
And then the rubber actually hit the road and it was like, you're at a Rage Against the Machine concert, but you had to get vaccinated first.
Oh, like, yeah. Okay. You know, we saw this Portland punk show, man. It was so funny. I don't know if anybody saw it was going around. These people were wearing like, no joke, like it looked like actual construction respirators for when you like remove asbestos. Yeah, like, I was like, dude, I haven't seen that mask before. Like they got like the 2037 masks, like for a couple cycles late. Like they got the advanced stuff. And I was just like, to me, like, I think life kind of naturally, as you get older, you there's like a form of like segregation that happens where you're just like, yeah, that's not me. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to be a huge, like, I disavow this community or something. You're just like, I'm older. I got the friends I need. That usually shrinks over time. But I remember thinking like, dude, man, I just don't think I could ever talk to that person like that. You know what I mean? Somebody who's at the all mask Portland punk show. Like, what if you had like a cool 5-minute conversation with somebody and then they're like, hey, what do you got going on later? Oh, I'm going to the all mask, like masked up, boosted Portland punk show. And I'm just
can I
have those 5 minutes back, please? Yeah.
Were they thinking the Portland mask block, BLOC? Like, thanks for supplying literally all the masks we needed, Portland mask block. And I'm like, who are these guys? Dude? What is this group that
the
is
Portland mask block, dude? Yeah. Oh my god. I saw that
and I didn't even read it. I was like, oh my god, I think I sent it to you. And
you need to do like a noir style journey into the port, like Thomas Pynchon, like style, like thing, because you're there. So like,
I don't know if you guys know, this is where I live.
You need to do like one of those like, or like proto Vice kind of things. Like turn it back on itself,
kind
of like old good Vice. Like you need to do that because I'm curious. But either way, man, like,
it's crazy. Just... yeah, what's actually funny, I was gonna there was when I lived with our old landladies a couple houses ago or whatever, they were super based on all this stuff during that. It was actually a blessing to be with them. They're like twin sisters, you know, and we rented I had a little spot like a tiny house out front, and it was a blessing to be around there 2020 2021 with those guys. And they went to all these crazy like secret Portland meetings because all the people that were like, yeah, masks are gay, dude. We don't want to do this shit. There was like a small percentage of people in town that would go to these little meetings. I never went. That's not even, I'm not even down with that shit. I'm like, whatever. I don't want to go to like a meeting about that stuff. But some guy from that little group or whatever came by and he was giving away a bunch of books. And this is, I think, right before Gain of Fiction started. And he's like, yeah, here you go. He gave me like a third of the list on Gain of Fiction.
That's crazy, dude.
Including Dahlgren and Blood Meridian and stuff. So I was like, okay, this guy's cool. You know,
that's a cool box, dude. If you got Samuel Delaney and Cormac McCarthy in there, like that's a guy where I'm like, well, what else you got going on?
Because I didn't know how cool it was at the time. I was like, oh, thanks. You know, these look pretty serious, you know. And then, yeah, shout out that guy. Yeah, he's cool.
Excellent. Yeah. So I guess the last thing I wanted to ask you guys, I asked Brad this last time, but like, who are you guys waiting on to die so you can cover? Like, no, I know you're not wishing death. I just mean like, you're like, man, like it would be kind of sick if we, cause you have rules. You got a year and a day. You can't.
I'll say one because I think he himself would appreciate it. I cannot wait until Doug Stanhope dies. Doesn't he do his own death pool and all that? I mean, and I love it. For many years. And this is a joke. I love
it. Of course. No,
Brad turned me on to Doug Stanhope many, many years ago. And I've since seen him 4 or 5 times.
Yeah,
funny comedian and a comedian's comedian, and he will be fun to cover because, of course, he's also a great writer. He's written a couple of memoirs, Digging Up Mother. I mean, come on,
yeah,
so good. Yeah,
so great, man. That is a tough question, man. Who would I want? There's no, you know, it's kind of. This is sort of strange. I mean, I tend to gravitate towards the writers, but like, there's not really a ton of living ones who I think I'm really dying to like dig into their juicy story.
That's another problem, right? Like,
right.
Yeah.
I want to do, but it's going to require a totally different kind of our effort than we normally put in. Thomas Ligotti, people might know Thomas Ligotti, mostly short stories, very much sort of, kind of doing what Lovecraft was doing, but very much in his own vein, kind of a nihilist, wrote these great short stories. Grimscribe is one collection. And then he also wrote a book of philosophy called The Conspiracy Against Man. And he lives in the Detroit area somewhere, but he's very reclusive. Nobody really knows anything about him. And, you know, maybe a few years from now, we can kick up a Art of Darkness Kickstarter and we can like, actually go do some like field research and some people who know him, that kind of thing.
That'd
so
be sick.
Yeah, there's a few that I mean look, there's I'm as a person with a list of things I'm going to cover, somebody's like, hey, you should do this, and I'm like, yeah, 2027, I'm on it, you know. Yeah. I'm not being a prick about it, but I'm like, yeah, that does sound good, but you know. But like Ambrose Bierce, I always thought would be like really good.
Yeah,
like,
we definitely he's on the list for sure.
H.G. Wells is an interesting one too. If you think you're running out of great artists, you do still have there's always gonna be too many, right? Like
we got like 4 or 5 seasons worth probably on our list, I would say. Wow. Right now.
Yeah,
that's what's cool about books. Yeah. It really extends your vision. You're like, oh yeah, this decade I could get to this, and it's kind of new to me, I feel. Yeah. You know, it's where music, you just put it on, it's of the moment and stuff.
Yeah, there are definitely like people we cover because it's like, it's not so much we just want to cover them, but we want to just like put our we want to look into that thing, that scene, that time, that place, whatever, and at least touch on somebody in that. I think we did that like with we did an episode on H.P. Lovecraft and one on Robert E. Howard, so like both kind of got this like weird American pulp era.
Yes.
Kind of somewhat, there's a couple other people who'd be worth talking about for sure, but like, you know, so we got something there, and we just did Flannery O'Connor, so now we've done Faulkner, so we got a toe in the Southern literature arena. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a bunch of these, so yeah, sometimes it might be about thinking like, hey, we haven't done a fill in the blank, you know, we need to find a good one.
Yeah, that's true, because you want to, and then like it's always cool what door that opens up, like, you know, when you get into like a thing, you're like, I didn't think I'd ever be like covering a country, you know, like I didn't grow up listening to country music, but like it's like once you realize, you're like, because that's kind of like what this is, right? At the end of the day, like everything you consume ends up being for something you're going to talk about when you do this. So it's kind of like, you know, people are like, well, it's so much work. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's something I'm interested in, you know, like at least it's fun, you know? And
yeah, I probably would be reading almost as much as I do, but it would be a lot more scatterbrained. It would be all over the place.
Well, and now you guys do both have your ventures other than the podcast world. Now Kevin is a playwright, which we didn't really talk about much there. I know about the COVID 2020 playwright stuff from Clifton Duncan, like kind of because he did a good job talking about how insane that field was. Like,
oh yeah,
it's theater kids. Yeah. I mean,
they've always been the vanguard of the mad. I mean, you know, the American theater people are the most deranged people on the planet. Oh, I mean, I'm part of it. You know, I'm going to a conference in Alaska in June. You know, I'm sure I'll win no friends saying this, but I think a lot of them I know many, many of them quietly go, we've gone crazy. We've lost our minds, but everybody does it on the DL because they're afraid of their reputation. And meanwhile, they've got to post all the right things all the time on Facebook. If you ever want to have, you know, any hope of a career. But I do my own thing. So I'm kind of at a, I don't give a damn point. And I have a theater company of my own called Bad Mouth Theater Company here in Minnesota. Right. It's badmouthtc.com. I'm working on lots of different projects. I'm working on with my writing partner, Abby Lucas. I'm working on a kind of an AI horror radio play script. That's going to be cool
for radio a group play. Called.
Yeah. Yeah. And this will come out online. So stay tuned.
Very cool.
This is through a group called, Dark Pony Radio, Shadow Horse Theater. They're like a local company. And here in the Twin Cities, we're also going to do my play Moderation, which is about online content moderators losing their minds at work. We are going to do that.
Never happens.
In town. Yeah, it's based on a real story. Town in St. Paul in October. So stay tuned for that. And then probably also in London. I'm talking with a director and a producer over there. And so things are happening. And, you know, theater got totally kicked in the teeth by COVID. And you would think these folks would be the first to stand up for IRL.
It's your job. You lost your job.
but they love their unions and they love their belonging and they love their NPR and their new God, if only the New York Times would one day review me, I could be a real boy or shim or girl or whatever. They're just, it's just like, you know, I'm 41 years old, dude. I'm done trying to play along, you know, and I'm not a hateful person either. Like I will meet people where they are and try to be civil and kind and Christian. But I just, after COVID too, it's a little bit like, well, go fuck yourself. I don't, you know, you are 100% the armband people. And, you know, the masks were armbands, man.
I agree. No, but the reason I brought that up, both of your ventures. Now they're both kind of long processes to put out. A lot of times, even by the time something comes out, you're kind of on to the next one. You're kind of like, okay, but it comes out. Now, Brad, you wrote a novel called House of Sleep. I will be getting, I know I said I'd get it to it last year, but it's coming this year, and we're going to have you on to talk about it. Because truly, I need to do a better job of reading the literally people who come on our show, like their stuff. So I need to do a better job of that. But now you're already on to your next novel. I heard that happen. But what's it like? Because the reason I love this form right here is because I'm putting this out right after we're done, right? It's out. It's done. People can consume it. You know, Tom Petty said the waiting is the hardest part, and that's true for me. I'm impatient. And even if something doesn't go as planned, next week's different, you know? These long-form things, like, how do you guys do that? How do you guys just sit on something for so long? How does it stay burning in your mind?
Yeah, you know, well, the writing is tough. I mean, it seems silly in a lot of ways to relate art and religion in some way, but I'll tell you for me, the thing that about writing that is quasi-religious is there's a certain degree of faith that's involved. And the faith is just that this process will be worth it in some way, and fill in what you mean by worth it. Right. And so that's always kind of motivating. I also just like the work. I would just be paid and I would do what I want to do, which is right. I mean, it's the first thing I do every day. But you know, it is challenging, especially when you're, you know, I'm pretty active on Twitter and that kind of thing. And you constantly want to be I'd love to be just sending stuff out, right? Just like,
right.
Here's the first chapter. Here's the second chapter.
Serializing almost.
Yeah. Right. But you end up kind of spoiling it. You can kind of spoil it for people that way. You're also going to put out stuff before it's actually ready.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a bit of a perfectionist on the writing side. Like, I need that thing baked to perfection. And if it's not, I'll just throw it in the garbage.
Right.
So all of that takes time, and it's taken me a while to like appreciate that. I mean, I've been working on the book I'm working on now. I've been working on it for almost four years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I'm almost done now. Final draft. I'm about a third of the way or so through the final draft. So it's coming later this year, one way or another. But
are you looking to self-publish or
I'm gonna try to not do that this time. We'll see though. We'll see
what was that? I mean, I've heard mixed things. We have good friends, Kelby Losak and J. David Osborne. They host a podcast called Agitator, and they're both writers. And I was to say, I'd love to see you guys collaborate in the podcast medium, because they have a thing called Broken River Collective, where it's like, it's not an official, like, you know, clock in, clock out factory thing, but it's just a bunch of writers that are like quasi self-publishing, but like together, you know. And I like that. I think that's the best way to do it, because it's got to be tough to just self-publish when everybody makes something. Like, it seems like everybody's got like a thing, and it's tough to stand out that way, and you want like the promotional money behind it.
Yeah.
So, like, I understand both, but also self-publishing, it's all you get it's you.
You know, self-publishing, I'll just be totally honest, you know, like, I think people have come across my book and be like, he chose to self-publish, how interesting. I mean, I take that as kind of a compliment, as though I had an option.
I
sent that novel to, or excerpts or the whole novel to 50 to 60 different agents and publishers.
Wow.
Nobody wanted it.
Yeah.
So I was sort of like, well, this was actually, there was like a moment kind of leading up to our Darkness coming out, where I really had a moment of like, oh, dude, sorry. And this is me talking to myself. Sorry, man, you don't get to be Cormac McCarthy. Like, you don't get to just like every once in a while send something in the mail and fat checks show up. Like, you're gonna have to do something different from that. So I thought I'll self-publish, and you know, I think when House of Sleep came out, I think I had 300 followers on Twitter, maybe. I didn't spend any time on there. The podcast came out and my book came out, I think the same month, actually, or within a month of each other. So the fact that it got rejected so hard, and I was like, there's no way, this is actually pretty good. Like, and I know, because I spent I spent 4 or 5 years working on that. So yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of rambling now, but that process is, you have to roll with the setbacks, I guess. Like, it's going to go, if it's not going to go your way, you got to figure out a way to make it happen some way or another. I mean, that's, it's a tough industry to do anything in. Yeah,
go ahead. Can I ask you about tarot?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's something else I do. Tarot reading. So
yeah, I want
for a reasonable fee, guys.
Yeah, for a reasonable fee.
I love the way
tarot readings are awesome.
Really? Yeah, you gave me a little, and I asked you on Twitter, and you were kind enough to throw down for me, because
you owe Brad money, actually.
I do. We'll
sell him later.
But I wanted, I just want to get the general gist of it, because I'm kind of getting into that.
Yeah.
But also, I know a lot, like, I have some friends, you seem pretty solid, but I know a lot of people that are into like tarot, and they're just like, oh, it's bad. Everything's bad on the deck. And I'm like, yo, I don't want to do this now. Cause it's really cool, and the art's cool, and you could tell it's vibed up. But also I want to avoid that aspect of it, and just be, obviously take bad cues if they come, but that's kind of my main question on it. Cause I'm thinking of one guy in particular. I'm just like, dude, maybe you need to like relax.
I mean, you know, it's funny, like, one piece of advice or way of thinking that is helpful for me. And it's funny, because I've taken it seriously, like almost as an academic subject for a while. And then the practice of actually giving readings is like kind of a whole nother thing. One thing is, to not take it too seriously. And this doesn't mean it's not real, or it's not helpful, or it's not meaningful, or it's not deep, but like, you have to kind of hold all of this stuff kind of carefully. Cause I think what happens, people are like, well, this is clearly an instruction from the universe about what I have to do.
Yeah.
Right. And even if it's not to that level, they can fall for like the Children's Illustrated Bible version. of what's happening. And that's no knock on the Bible. It's like they had to simplify things so kids would understand some of the core concepts, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So that would be one thing. And I think before, how would I put this? You really need to spend some time. One thing that can be helpful is spend some time just trying to figure out what the cards mean according to various people who've written about them before you even relate them to yourself. So you pull a card and it's not like, what does this mean to me? It's like, just generally, what does this mean?
Right. Yeah.
And then as you kind of stack some of those up, I think later when you bring them together, you can be a little bit more analytical about what these patterns are suggesting rather than. Okay. So then the devil pops up and it's not about being demonically possessed.
Right.
It's about
the
fact that you eat too many donuts or something.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it might be. Yeah.
I didn't know that they have roots with the playing cards, the 52 card deck, and it's almost the same in a lot of ways. I thought that was cool. And
yeah, it's basically the same deck. It came out of like Italian card playing in the 1300s, actually.
Anyways,
guys, I'm thank you guys for coming through. I'd love to do this again sometime. It's a lot of fun. I like to get you guys away from your source material a little bit, you know what I mean? And of course we talked about some of your subjects, but it's always fun. I think it's always good to have other places where somebody can bring out, you know, this is the Art of Darkness core episode. That's basically what we were just
there
doing.
There we go. Glenn, Cy, I appreciate the opportunity because you're right. It's like we just did a couple episodes in the last week and we come in, we got notes, we're ready to go.
Right.
We're trying to make something entertaining, but I explicitly said
there are no topics. There are nothing. I'm just like, which I think we all can agree is good to do sometimes because the source material stuff gets out of hand, but we got to keep doing this sometime. And definitely I'm trying to find a way to peel you guys away so you can come on my fiction show.
Ooh.
Just because I hate giving people who do fiction I hate giving them more work because it's tough. Like, you know, it's like,
are you all gonna do Dune at some point?
Dude, I might have to because I can't finish it. It's one of the few books I just couldn't do. But I am Sisyphus though. Like when I find out I can't finish a book, like, or something, or I can't get into something, I force myself to do it. So I think I might need to Dune it, you know?
Because Brad and I are both obsessed, or at least we appreciate Dune 2. I am obsessed. I've been obsessed like five times. And our reading schedule is so gnarly that we're like, okay, how are we actually going to reread the book? And we're like, well, we have a book club, so let's throw it into the book club at the end of this year. So I'm just saying, we're already going to be reading Dune, you know, like around December time. But anytime. I mean, and it doesn't have to be that. I don't mean to.
I want to do something that you've already read, perhaps, to where like or something you know a lot. Now I know, Kevin, you're a big Jonathan Franzen fan, so I would like to do the correction.
No, are you teasing?
At some point.
Yeah, you're teasing. I actually like the corrections.
I want to do it. I've never read it, but my mom used to cycle books a lot. She would cycle it out, and it was always on, but that was the one that she never returned to the bookstore. Like that was always like I would just see, I didn't know what it was.
That was her Dune. The corrections was your mom's Dune.
Why do you think I'm a giant Franzen fan?
You've brought it up on the show. I listened to
Have
her
I? Darkness.
Yes, you have. You absolutely have brought up.
All right. No, I'm a big,
don't make
I am
me
a
go,
big,
don't
I'm
make,
a, okay, no, that's fine. No, no, no. I'm just like trying to, it. I'm trying to. T-
I'll
say a lot of shit online about a lot of things, Glenn.
This was on a pod. You had said the corrections. Yeah. I don't know. Obviously, he's alive. It wasn't
Freedom too.
Yeah.
Freedom is like set right here in St. Paul. It's a great kind of St. Paul novel.
I'm not teasing at all. I haven't read him. I want to read him.
We could do like Tree of Smoke would be a banger to do. Under the Volcano. If you all haven't done Under the Volcano, Brad and I would totally be able to
something.
Come on.
Yeah,
the
other
one would be
fun,
DeLillo. Is it Omega Point, Brad?
Yeah,
that one.
I think we're talking. We could find something short. I could throw you some ideas. I'd focus on shorter stuff, probably like
that. No, I agree.
100 page
agreed.
Or less.
Agreed. Yeah, yeah,
probably
agreed.
Kind of stuff. There's plenty of good candidates in that.
All right. Yeah. Well, then we'll have to do that. Cause I just like, that's always the eternal thing. It's like, they cover this, we should collaborate, but when, you know, like on that, it's much easier to invite you guys on to riff, you know, which is always fun, but I do want to eventually get you guys in the GOF lab, dude.
That'd
be great. Anyways, Art of Dark Pod, patreon.com/artofdarkpod. Go there first. Yeah. Go there first. Do that first, and then work your way back there. House of Sleep. Be on the lookout for. I'm sorry. Say the play one more time.
Moderation.
Yeah. Be on the lookout for that. Well, everybody have a safe week. Catch you guys next time.